I teach in the Torrey Honors College, and we read this text in the sophomore year. We just had a group of students go on a weekend camping trip and read it straight through together with a couple of faculty members there. And so I didn't get to go on that. Simultaneously, we had freshmen reading Plato's Republic, at least the first four books, which is about all you can stand as freshmen to be read aloud. Dante's Divine Comedy is a great text. It's very rich. It just keeps giving back. And so I want to talk about two angles on it in these two lectures. One is the doctrine of salvation, as presented in Dante's work, and the other one is the doctrine of God. And so for the salvation talk, I'll be mainly working with the purgatory. It's kind of an introduction to volume two. It says Inferno, Purgatory, and Paradise. So this one will be mainly the purgatory talk, and then the talk about the doctrine of God will be mainly from the paradise or the paradiso. And my main mode is going to be trying to learn what we can learn from. Well, look at that. Finally went to sleep. Sorry, the Windows 11 is trying to sell itself to me here. Don't look at my password, everybody. All right, there we are. So since it's a great text, since it's a proven classic, since generations of Christians have testified to how great the Divine Comedy is and how worth reading, I want to emphasize what we have to learn from it. Then I'm going to turn a corner and be critical for a minute and say what I, as a conservative evangelical Protestant theologian, want to register as a complaint or a caution or something that I think is left out of the Divine Comedy that that we can bring to it. And then I'll kind of synthesize that and make a final kind of theological statement of having learned all we can learn from Dante's theology of salvation in the Divine Comedy, what can we put together as a more stable, a more defensible, a more robust, a more living kind of evangelical doctrine of salvation? So let's jump right into it. I'll be illustrating this with some visual images. The Divine Comedy has the great advantage of having drawn a lot of artistic imaginations. Dante's writing is very image-driven, verbal images. He's constantly proposing to you mental pictures. And so visual artists have jumped right on that, and from way before the time of printing, we have these wonderful manuscripts. This is from the late 1400s, a painted, illuminated manuscript of a scene at the very top of the Purgatory, where he kind of like gets to the top of the Purgatorio and has a vision of this restored earthly paradise. So it's got these heavenly elements. And if you look at this and think like, that's kind of a mess, there's too much going on in that picture, that means it's an accurate illustration of what's going on in that part of the Divine Comedy, because all sorts of wild stuff that you have not been prepared for just suddenly appears in this giant sort of ceremonial parade all of a sudden. There's a griffin, there's a cart, there's the four evangelists, there's all kinds of stuff. Okay, well, here is an illustration of Dante. This is a painting on the wall in Florence, Dante's beloved city that he had the love-hate relationship with. On the left, you see the Inferno, looking damned and damnable over there. Behind him, you see Purgatory right above his gesturing hand. And you might expect to read across left to right, hell, Purgatory, heaven. But instead of heaven, you get Florence itself. And heaven, you have to look up for. So the rings of heaven are above. Here's Dante making his gesture. I'm going to explain how Dante's Purgatory works. So for those of you who already know the text, this will be a little bit of review. And for the rest of you, this will be kind of a brief explanation of what Dante's doing with his imaginative construct of the mountain of Purgatory and its cornices. So theologically, I want to say that the great thing going on in Dante's Purgatory is the realism with which he approaches the disorder of the soul and how it could be set back into order. By realism, I mean he has the idea that moral realities are, they're actual, they're objective. Now, I think a lot of us believe this, but it's hard to remember because they're invisible, right? Something is in your soul that is either shaped the right way and ordered the right way or is disordered and misshapen. But you can't see the soul, it's invisible. You can only see it through its effects. You can see it through your moral conduct, or you can see the soul on an Aristotelian view, which is what Dante basically has. You can see the soul in the body that it uses to express itself. Like there's a way in which my body just is my soul, but having worked its way out in the physical world. Here I am up here doing, my soul is dancing by moving my body around to dance, right? But the actual structure of the soul is not visible to us. Nevertheless, we need to insist it's objective. Your soul can be either the soul of a thief or the soul of an honest person. And so there's either the shape of stealing in your invisible, immaterial, but objectively real soul, or there's the shape of giving things their proper due. Dante is focused on that so well that he's sort of acted the entire thing out or staged a drama having to do with the objective disorder and reordering of the soul. Really valuable. We'll come back to why that's so helpful for us in our modern context in a minute. But resulting from that realism about the objective disorder and reordering of the soul is a moral theology of vices and virtues. This is kind of the brass tacks of how he works out the shape of your soul. He's like, well, there's a rightly ordering soul manifests certain virtues. And when that doesn't go well, a wrongly ordered soul manifests certain vices. And then the fun bit and the famous bit is that he comes down to real details about what that looks like. So that brings us to purgatory. Here's a little illustration of the angel there at St. Peter's Gate. He's got little three steps in front of him that Dante walks you through. He is inscribing on everyone's head the seven forms of the letter P. And as you go up through the cornices or terraces of purgatory, one of those will be removed as you sort of work through that. It's very video game-like. I know Dante wasn't thinking about video games, but you think of bring, 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 going to the next level. A little coin vanishes, you got money. So there's the angel letting them in, and you see the cornices of purgatory, and here's a diagram in which they're labeled. So you got lower purgatory with the proud, the envious, and the wrathful. Then there's this kind of special strange one for the slothful, and you get upper purgatory for the covetous, the gluttonous, and the lustful. And at each of these, a soul in its sort of, they don't have their actual bodies with them, they're disembodied souls, but they got sort of figurative or aerial, airy sorts of bodies in which they can undergo the purgings of Mount Purgatory. I'll come back to that in a minute. Let me just move on to how this actually works. On each cornice, you have a sort of working out of the sin or the vice appropriate to that cornice. So Dante then has this theology of transformation. That is to say, a soul enters this cornice with a disorder, with a messed up, vicious element, and goes through a process that acts out what it would take to put that moral thing back into the right shape. So there's a real transformation here. Let me just give you as an illustration. First of all, here are the eight elements that happen on each cornice. When I write them down like this, it makes it sound like he's got a checklist and every cornice is going to be like, okay, here come the eight elements, ba-da-boom, ba-da-boom, ba-da-boom. But Dante works it out so artistically. He does have a theology. I'm going to be describing that theology the way you might expect a systematic theologian to do it. But you got to bear in mind, the whole thing is poetry. The whole thing works out in meter and is driven by imagery and by narrative. It's sometimes hard to track these eight elements because he weaves them in so artfully and naturally into the way it develops. But here they are. At each cornice, for each vice, moving you towards a specific virtue, there's a discipline and a meditation. These go together. They've got a positive and a negative side. The discipline is some task that you undergo which causes you to move on to the virtue and be held back from the vice. So that's why the discipline is said to have a whip and a bridle, right? If you think about managing a horse, there's something to move you on to the good thing and hold you back from the bad thing. And this is always paired with a meditation. So it's not just that you do a thing to work out this vice and work in the virtue, but you also meditate and form your mind around the nature of the virtue you're seeking to embrace. So instead of pride, you don't just get told, stop being prideful. Here, meditate on bad, prideful people and how bad they are. Instead, you see a model of virtue, and you wrap your mind by meditation around the virtue of humility. And then you have some sort of exercise that you do to give yourself like practice, actual practice in that virtue. There, on every level, there's an artwork. Usually, I think it's song, just because of the nature of the poetic art that Dante's doing. It's easier to put song in there, so you get actual song lyrics from songs known to him at the time. Some of them are liturgical, some of them are biblical. And then occasionally, they're not musical arts, they're visual arts. So on the cornice that we're going to look at here on Pride, it's actually stone carvings, relief carvings on the wall. And Dante describes them to you verbally, what his characters are seeing visually. What's the word for when you do that? Ekphrasis. Ekphrasis is when you describe one art form in another art form. So like poetry about a relief sculpture, that's a fancy word for that is ekphrasis. Somebody said talking about art is like dancing about architecture, right? So that you get that move, like when you're portraying in one art form the results of another art form. On every cornice, there's Mary as an example. This is, if you hadn't picked up yet, that we're deep in Catholic territory. The presence of Mary on each cornice is going to alert you to the fact that, oh yeah, you know, Dante died in the early 1300s. This is before the Reformation. Let me just say this, a kind of a little drive-by comment here from a Protestant. When you decide to promote Mary to a major character in your spiritual scheme, there's a lot of benefits of that, like you get the Magnificat and you get some cool things from if you've never attended enough to the character of Mary in Scripture, like, oh, there she is. This lens on that will really highlight something I may not have seen before in my Protestant world. The downside is Mary is, objectively speaking, a minor character in the Bible. And so if you want her represented on each cornice, you're going to need 7 cool quotes from her, and there are barely 7 in Scripture. And especially if you're going to correlate them with a moral framework, you end up having to, like, for drunkards, you have to have her say, they're out of wine, which is a thing Mary said. It's one of the handful of things that Mary said. She really is. I'm not insulting her to say she's a minor character in the New Testament. So Dante's decision to incorporate her into every cornice actually, counterintuitively, it proves the point that she's a minor character, because he's really got to work it hard to find 7 lines from her. But she's there. There's a prayer on every cornice. There's a purification of the senses. So this doesn't always work, but with some senses you can, with some sins, with some vices, you can say what sense that kind of lives in, right? The eyes or the ears or the taste would correlate with things like sloth or gluttony or lust or lechery, things like that. Then there's the benediction, a blessing of some kind, and this correlates with the removing of one of the peas that the angel has carved into your head. And then there's a beatitude in the sense of blessed are the 7 beatitudes from the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew 5. Okay, so all that happens on each of the cornices, and it's kind of a system. Like when you have that, you are purged or free of that vice. Here's a different artist illustrating the cornice of Pride, and you see here Dante and Virgil. How good is that projection? Yeah, you can see that. They're actually labeled, again, a video game element here. There's a V and a D over the heads of the 2 characters. And here they are walking onto the cornice. They're looking at a carving of Mary receiving the Annunciation from the angel, and she says, be it to me according to your word. Right? And this is taken as a posture of humility and reception and submission to the will of God. And so meditation here on Mary is an example of the virtue here. This is the meditation. It's delivered through art. And the discipline that then goes with it, you can see these guys coming up behind. I'm like, yep, we are on the cornice of Pride, and our job is to carry rocks. And we carry those rocks mainly because that causes us to look down at the ground. Because as opposed to our prideful activity of looking up and thinking like, we are so great, everybody look at me. Instead, we're looking down. And so the discipline that these souls submit to is the downward attention of their eyes held down by this burden. They meditate on the virtue of humility. And then later on, I actually meant to look this up and refresh my memory for why they end up having to get stomped on by people. But they eventually get to stomp on devils on their way out of the cornice of purgatory. And then this brings us to why this works. Let me say that Dante's version of purgatory is the happiest, friendliest, nicest possible version of purgatory. You can do a historical survey of what everyone has taught about this afterlife thing. And for Dante, here's a couple lines that Dorothy Sayers especially likes to teach from him. First of all, the more they climb, the easier it grows. So when you're down on the lower cornices trying to work out those vices, it's difficult. There's a lot of labor involved. But the higher up you get, the more you're sort of drawn upward by the power of grace or the power of heaven. Paradise is actually sort of like magnetically pulling you up the mountain. And so it's a happy place. People are happier the further they go. They're carrying rocks and stuff. Some of them are getting burned. All sorts of bad things are happening. There's pain on purgatory, but there's not suffering for suffering's sake. Purgatory for Dante is definitely an outpost of heaven. Everyone there is definitely going to be saved in the end. They are cleared from the danger of punishment in hell. And they are willingly submitting to this change because they want to be objectively transformed. Yeah. And then this other line that Sayers likes to quote, the will itself attests its own purgation. It's kind of a fancy way to say what Sayers then paraphrases as, God is satisfied when they are satisfied. In other words, like, oh, gee, I'm proud. How will I know when I'm humble enough to get out of this pride prison? And the answer is, you'll know when you're actually humble enough. Like, because remember, it's objective. It's not a matter of, I did a bad thing and I need to be punished. It's sort of a legal arrangement, and when I've served my time, I'll get out. It's not about serving time. It's about actually stopping being proud. And so when you go through the discipline of ceasing to be proud and being humble instead, then you go to the next level. It's a little magic video game thing. And it's not as if some angel or some other force or even God himself is sitting there going, you know, you've got to be here for 1,000 years. It's actually when the process of purgation does its purging and you're clean, when your soul is objectively reordered, that's when you go to the next level, which re-alerts you to the fact that for Dante, this is all an imaginative visualization of what the process of soul transformation is like. You know, it's as if this is a huge metaphor where he's saying, like, what would it be like to stop being proud and begin to be humble? It would be like going to the next level morally. It would be like actually having done that work so you're actually different, and then you're ready to go on to the next thing. There are other versions of purgatory out there, of course. If you do a history of the doctrine of purgatory before Dante and after Dante, Dante really stands out as the shiniest possible, happiest possible, friendly, affirming, like, hey, can't wait for purgatory. It'd be great to quit being vicious and instead start being virtuous. Before and after this, purgatory sounds like what it probably sounds like in popular culture, like a slightly less bad version of hell, right? That's how people use that, like, oh, you're going to go to hell for that. I don't know, maybe it's not that bad. Maybe you'll just go to purgatory. Or if you think about just on the eve of the Reformation, what the doctrine of purgatory had turned into, it's a terrible place of torment where you need to pray for your departed ancestors to get out of there. And you can do various things in the sacramental system of the church to get them out of some purgatory. You can pay money to help us build St. Peter's. If you pay more money, great-grandpa can get out of purgatory sooner. We can actually hear him screaming. People would have visions of souls in purgatory screaming and burning and saying, won't you please pay the church some money to get me out of here? These kinds of abuses are built in. All this is presupposing the idea of purgatory as mainly a bad place. If you think about the idea of paying some money to get a relative out of purgatory early, it totally undercuts Dante's version of it, right? For Dante's version, like, you don't want off of one of those cornices until you're actually not a thief. You can't get bought out of being a thief. That undercuts the entire value of what Dante's doing with the system, which is to say it's about objective, actual moral transformation. You see how money undercuts that whole system. So kind of an internal problem in the Catholic tradition of teaching on purgatory. Okay, well, I have taught as best I can there how Dante's purgatory works, but of course here I want to say, actually it doesn't work, right? I mean, as a Protestant evangelical, I want to say I'm not here to pitch a system of purgatory. This is just a great print of Dante as the author, surrounded by his the different elements of his Divine Comedy. Down below you've got the Inferno, lower left, and then Purgatory Mountain, bottom right. We won't have time to look at this in this lecture, but up above, you have heaven laid out in with multiple circles, and the awareness here from the artist that Dante's got a positive vision of purgatory. So if you see the borders of this illustration, they're angels all the way around it, except in the bottom left corner, they're little devils and bats, right? And if this artist hadn't understood what Dante was up to, he would have put devils and bats over on the purgatory side too, on the whole lower register. But this artist recognizes, nope, for Dante, purgatory is an outpost of heaven. It's not a transition zone or anything. It's actually, souls are definitely on their way to heaven. Purgatory is where they are objectively reordered before getting there. Okay, well, let me just talk for a minute about how purgatory doesn't work, and here comes just three Protestant objections to the doctrine of purgatory, even at its best, which is how we get it in Dante. First of all, the question is, in the whole meditation on purgatory, where is Christ's objective work of atonement? If you visualize this transformation process as a mountain, as Dante does so well, the question is, at what point does the work of Christ Jesus on the cross accomplish anything that actually empowers the reordering of your soul or does the reordering of your soul? Like, just where is the cross? To put it in picture form, where is the atoning death of Jesus Christ on this mountain of purgatory? It's really not there. So you've got kind of a couple options at the extremes with some variations in between. One is, remember St. Peter, remember the angel sitting there with the sword at St. Peter's gate, the three steps in front of him? One of those steps is cracked crosswise. And so some interpreters will say, there's the cross, right there. Like they had to go up through one of the steps is like a shiny alabaster that reflects your own face back at you. Then the next step is, I think, red or black, and it has a cross-shaped crack in it. So some people will say, like, that was it. To which I would reply as a Protestant, that's not enough cross. Like, if your story's about a mountain and one of three steps has a crack in it, like, that's just, I want rather more of the work of Christ in the crucifixion and death than that. The other answer at the other extreme is, the whole mountain is the cross. Like, the entire mountain of purgatory is a figurative way of showing the transforming power of the cross. And I think that's a stretch. I think... we want to learn all we can from what Dante's doing with purgatory, but I don't think you can describe it as anything like atonement or vicarious punishment or the work of Christ accomplishing the transformation of the soul. I think it's all somehow downstream from that. This is not to say that Dante has no doctrine of the atonement. When you get to Paradise, Canto 7, there's a theological conversation there, which has some wonderful grist for the mill of teaching the doctrine of the atonement. My point here is just where Dante's heart is, in his presentation of the transformation of the soul in the work of purgatory, the cross is not prominent. Second, justification in this system, and this tracks with Roman Catholic theology in general, including how it's taught at the Council of Trent in the era of the Reformation, is sort of an anti-Protestant version of putting this later on in the Council of Trent. Justification is used as a term for completed sanctification. So I got this word running up the mountain of purgatory for you to show that this process of moral transformation, it's not works righteousness. It's helped by grace. It's divinely empowered. You can't do this on your own. You need the power of God to help you reorder your soul in this way. And when your soul is actually reordered, then at the top of Mount Purgatory, God can look at you and say, that is justified. I accept that. This is acceptable in my sight because through teamwork, through transformation, through this moral formation process, you have become actually perfected. And when that's done, when that process of sanctification is full, then God will look at you and say, that's acceptable, you are now justified. Until then, you're in a state of grace, you're safe and all that, but you're not actually just before God. The Protestant teaching, of course, follows biblical usage and says, no, there's got to be a declaration of you being accepted by God in your sins, so that then you can enter the process of sanctification. So, short version here of Protestant-Catholic polemics is, for Protestants, first you're justified, then you get sanctified. On the Catholic usage, they use the word slightly differently. It's a process of sanctification, at the end of which you are declared just. And Dante's Mountain of Purgatory is an excellent objective illustration of that. Third objection, I think, is really straightforwardly obvious. When you start talking about this sort of moral transformation after death, you're in a zone where you're going to mythologize the afterlife. And what I mean by that is, even artistically, where do you get the material for this kind of teaching about the afterlife? You really have to make it up. I mean, this is kind of a fundamentalist way to put it, but it's just not in the Bible, right? So as a result, all the gorgeous, rich detail of angels carving letters on your head and carrying rocks around and saints and images and pictures and all that kind of stuff, it's just made up from scratch, right? It's just got to be generated by the artistic imagination. Dante has a healthy, robust, theologically well-informed Christian imagination, and so the results are pretty good in a way that I'll point out here in a minute. But when you look around at the other versions of purgatory, including books you can buy like right now from the Leaflet Missal Company, like I get these in the mail. I actually get weird Halloween mailings from the Roman Catholic Leaflet Missal Company that say, like, souls in purgatory are screaming. Pretty scary, huh? And I think, like, wow, that's a... If I were choosing doctrines of purgatory, I'm picking the Dante one, not the one currently in print from this publisher. But what you do have to say is, like, once you're mythologizing the afterlife and generating a bunch of content about what goes on after death to the soul, that's the kind of danger you're in for all the time. There's something subjective about how theologically sound or not your version of this is. Okay, so that is how Dante's vision of moral transformation works. And then there's some biblical and Protestant evangelical critiques of it. And now I want to move on briefly to kind of a reconstructive zone here. So evangelical soteriology, that's the fancy word for the doctrine of salvation, fortified by Dante. So what would it be like to frame a good Protestant evangelical idea of salvation that learned as much as it possibly could from Dante, took the good, registered its objections, but moved on from there. So first of all, a holistic vision of real transformation. I think to just come back to the first point about this, the objective sense that there's such a thing as vice and virtue, that even though this is an invisible thing, we can't see it directly in the soul, nevertheless, it works its way out in the rest of our lives, and there's really such a thing as, think of each of the seven cornices, a real virtue and a real deformation or wrong working out of that thing that manifests itself as a vice. The doctrine of Christian salvation has got to include both the element of free forgiveness. We sometimes use the technical word forensic for that. That's when God reckons something to be true or declares something to be true. And it also has to include real transformation. And I would say that if your view of salvation is entirely forensic and doesn't include any sort of plan for how to actually stop acting sinfully, how to actually get vices out of your life and move into more Christ-like ways of being, into actually taking on these virtues, if it's all one and none of the other, the good news is Dante's book exists and you can read it and say, wow, look at all the actual transformation present here. Now, it's done in sort of storybook form. It's got this sort of medieval Catholic veil over it. You have to carry around a book called Purgatory and explain to people why you would do such a thing, right? But you can actually learn from it incredible moral wisdom. And here's one thing I want to say about eliminating vices and taking on virtues. It's got to be done by grace. You need the power of God working through you to do it. It takes some willpower, okay? But it's not mostly about willpower necessarily. This tradition of moral reasoning and wisdom enables you to say, and this is especially helpful if you're a thinker or if you think you're a thinker, right? If you like reading books and understanding things. What this means is you can understand what a sin is and understand how it's a deviation from a good, something good. You can understand how a vice descends by decay from a virtue, and you can understand what the virtue is. Then, of course, you do have to engage your willpower and actually change, but think about how far you've come if you understand it. You know what I mean? If there's actually moral knowledge that can be had, and there are wise teachers who can transmit it to you, it's such a difference. It's the difference between just thinking, like, I'm bad, and I need to be better, so I'm just going to grit my teeth harder and breathe a lot more shallow and, like, tighten my shoelaces, and I'm just going to start being good. And then you try that a few times and realize it didn't work and think, like, what's wrong with me? I must not be gritting my teeth hard enough. I'd better just crank up the willpower more. And you try that some more, and it doesn't work. And the years go by, and all you've done is gotten an ulcer, and you haven't actually gotten vices out of your life and gotten any more virtues. The fact that there's a tradition of moral wisdom that can actually instruct you to understand what the vice is, how it works, why it works that way, what the virtue is that it's failing to achieve, it can be a real game changer. I teach in college, and I always have to be careful when I teach about the vice of sloth, because 18 to 22-year-olds have really inaccurate ideas about what sloth is. They think sloth has something to do with sleeping too much. And so they sleep less in an attempt to be less slothful. And as a result, they walk around like stupid zombies during their waking hours, when what they ought to be doing is sleeping more and working more effectively, right? So what's going on there is they have an inaccurate, uninformed understanding of what sloth is. They're just going from some cartoon image of what it is. Like, I guess it's sleeping in. I'd better sleep less. And then they try to function as intelligent moral beings with 4 hours of sleep a night. And it's just the basic animal substructure of behaving as a responsible moral being is undercut by that. Why? A wrong idea of sloth. An unexamined, uneducated, uninformed idea of what sloth is. They think it's a certain kind of laziness, and they're unable to analyze what's really going on in their life. So just one example of many. In each of these areas where sin is a besetting thing, there's a possibility of tapping into moral knowledge about what it is. And then praying and using your willpower, then engaging that willpower, as opposed to just trying to do it with sheer brute force, no matter what the sin is. So, a holistic vision of real transformation. This is tied to the idea of effort in spiritual disciplines. So we think about spiritual disciplines, habits that we take on personally or communally, and we think, well, I could do those, and those would be valuable as long as they don't take work. Because if they take work, then that is opposed to grace. And so I just need to somehow naturally, through this organic flow of the fruit of the Spirit, have these spiritual disciplines happen. But as soon as they're hard, that's bad, because I'm Protestant, so I'd better not be working at this. Like, well, I think it's Dallas Willard who blew this away by saying, grace is not opposed to effort. It's opposed to merit, right? Grace is against the idea of you earning and deserving something, but grace is not opposed to the idea of you working at something. And so for all the disadvantages we could talk about this vision of purgatory that Dante presents, the fact that the souls involved are actually doing hard work, like it takes labor, it takes effort, I think that's a valuable thing. If we could understand that a grace-empowered, not trying to earn my salvation, but really just wanting to be more like Jesus with God's help, that fits. And so you might, in fact, have to work at things like praying more, giving more, abstaining from certain sins and vices. This might take, in fact, some effort. And that doesn't make it an unsanctified, just carnal attempt at self-salvation. So effort involved in spiritual disciplines. Before I go on to point C, let me say one more thing about needing a Protestant evangelical doctrine of salvation that includes real transformation and that involves effort. If you overemphasize the forensic side of things, the God declares me righteous kind of stuff, if you overemphasize that and never supplement it with actual ongoing moral transformation, it puts you in a danger zone, which I want to state carefully, but it's something like this. If you state everything in such a way that it never shows up in your life and you have arguments for why it's never going to show up in your life, it's going to be hard to tell your theology apart from mythology. Right? Now I want to worry here about mythology and Dante's afterlife mythology of this purgatory thing, which doesn't exist and isn't real. But I also want to warn about a kind of Protestant mythology, which is sort of like, what would this form be? I did a certain thing at a certain young age in my life. I answered an altar call, or I said a prayer, or I got baptized, or I did whatever the thing is. And as a result, skip my entire life, at the end of my life, I'll go to heaven, and I won't go to hell. That way of stating that view of salvation is impossible to distinguish from pure mythology. That might just be a thing that somebody says who is not engaged with spiritual reality, but has learned a certain thing to say, right? I want to press that and say, that kind of person, I can't see into their heart. I can't see into the heart of what has gone on between them and God. But the things they say about that are so disengaged from actual experience and life that it could be indistinguishable from purely mythological statements. And so a Protestant, a fully articulated Protestant doctrine of salvation has to include this forensic element, free justification by the grace of God, but it also has to issue in actual transformation. That's why you get to the third point, which is the doctrine of good works. Tom McCall over at Asbury Seminary has recently published a book called The Doctrine of Good Works. It's a Protestant theology of why good works are valuable, necessary, and an integral part of Christian existence. To be able to do that in an authentically Protestant way that doesn't lose its grip on the fact that God justifies sinners, right? That when we were yet sinners, Christ died for us and pronounces us justified and accepts us on the basis of his work for us, his work for us rather than his work in us, but that the work for us and the work in us are a package deal. They go together, and everyone truly engaged with God in a spiritually real way is going to both rejoice in free forgiveness by God's work for us and real transformation in ongoing partnership with God through God's work in us. So that's a challenge to a complete, robust doctrine of salvation that takes on from Dante this moral wisdom of transformation. I could give you lots of examples of theologians who do this in the Protestant tradition. One of my favorites is Isaac Ambrose. Isaac Ambrose is a Puritan. He would go on, I think like once a year, he would go on a month-long retreat out into the woods where he would just like meditate on God and Scripture. It's a wild kind of a thing. It sounds monastic. Like you think, like, how'd you get time off work? How did that even work? But anyway, there he is. He wrote this great little book called Ultima. Good title, huh? The Last Things. Long title, long Puritan subtitle here. In reference to the first and middle things, or certain meditations on life, death, judgment, hell, right purgatory, and heaven. Now, this is, no one's coming to get his Protestant card. He's a Puritan, he's a Calvinist, the whole deal. But on this one section of Ultima, The Last Things, he talks about right purgatory. And in this context, he talks about moral transformation, sanctification, but he roots it all in the text here, Hebrews 1:3, when he had by himself purged our sins. And so you see the trick Ambrose is doing here. He's playing on the long medieval tradition of talking about the need for purgation, and he's saying the right view of purgation is not in some sort of after we bury you, then you go on this undocumentable imaginary soul journey up a mountain that doesn't exist in the afterlife, but actually in this life to be transformed by the work of the Holy Spirit. That's the right doctrine of purgatory. It's on the basis of the finished work of Christ, which makes full provision for the purgation that needs to happen to us. And so that's how Ambrose taught it. I could give more examples of all kinds of good, engaged Protestant theologies that make room for moral transformation on the basis of free salvation. But I want to leave time for questions.